I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know, the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
And I think it's on YouTube also. Just look up Sleeping Beauties, Jamie Babbitt. But I'm sure it's a crappy version. But
that won't stop any lesbian.
No, I know. And Clea's so cute in it. It's so cute.
I'm dyking out, you're dyking out. Let's dyke out together, see what it's all about.
Dyking out, dyking out, dyking out, dyking out.
Hi, and welcome to Dyking Out, a podcast that asks the tough questions like happiest season or crappiest season. I'm Carolyn Bergier.
And I'm Melody Kamali.
And today we are dyking out with filmmaker, director, writer, and dykon Jamie Babbitt about what other than But I'm a cheerleader. Yes, so excited. A couple of announcements. First, you know, you can get more content from us on Patreon. I've got a lot of extra content that's sitting in the to-be-edited folder, but we just recorded, I think, a solid 90 minutes about happiest season.
Oh, it was a little more than that.
With past guest Erica Rose, and we'll be getting that up soon. We also have an episode that we did that I need to edit about body hair with one of our actual patrons who won it through one of our Zoom shows. She got to dyke out with us, and we talk about body hair with Zoe. So that's going to be up there soon. And a couple other things I think that need to go up. So I will be editing too fast, too furiously to get this content up on Patreon. We're also on Jemmy. If you want to support us in other ways, jemmy.app/dykingout. And you can also, some of you have bought some of our Dyke the Halls merch on our Etsy shop. So there are a couple cute options for that if you want a gift for you or a loved one to gay up the holidays, because happiest season didn't do it. So
our last announcement. You know, all we want for Christmas is for you to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. and Rosie O'Donnell to come on the pod. But, you know.
That's mostly me. But thank you, Melody, for being so considerate. Yeah. You don't even have to write anything. You can just hit 5 stars. But we also love reading positive 5-star reviews. And you can even sneak back some feedback in there. We're especially receptive to feedback from a 5-star reviewer. Mm-hmm. Because you are very kind and thoughtful and nice to do that. So such a big week. I can't believe it's been almost a week since our Lesbian Bar Project show. What a whirlwind this week has been.
I mean, really.
Between that, Thanksgiving, happiest season.
I'm exhausted.
It's been a crazy week. Yeah, I'm so tired.
Of all the holidays this year, though, I have to say Lesbian Bar Project was a night to remember. Truly a holiday for me, a gay holiday.
Yes, it was. What a night. We had past guests from the podcast, also possibly future guests of the podcast. We got to dike out with Leo Shang from the L Word Generation Q, who is just what a heartthrob.
I know.
What a tender queer heartthrob.
Guys, so much more somehow dreamy on Zoom than on Showtime.
Right. I know. Everybody was swooning in the chat, especially when Leo said that he was, in fact, single.
Yes.
So I wonder if he got any DMs during or after the show. We also had Allie Clayton. Have you heard of her?
I think so.
We had Sydney Washington. We had Emma Willman. We had Cameron Esposito. Mary Lambert and Leah Delaria sent in videos ahead of time just for the show. So it was crazy. DJ Shaw Savage, I always have to shout her out because she does such a great job of bringing the energy to these Zoom shows. And thank you to everybody who came and donated money. We raised over $8,000 that night for the Lesbian Bar Project. And the Lesbian Bar Project, it was a 30-day fundraising campaign that has ended, and they raised over $117,000 to be divided amongst the 15 remaining lesbian bars. So hopefully that helps to keep them open, to keep staff getting paid, and when this pandemic is over, we can't wait to get drinks at every single one of those bars.
We're doing a whole tour.
Yes, in the Dodge Caravan.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, the show was so much fun. There was a little bit of drama in the chat with Allie's story.
Oh, are we gonna?
So Allie was on the show and told the story that we've talked about in the episode with Mo Welch. We got it from Mo Welch's perspective, which doesn't capture Allie's experience for that night.
And totally different experience.
What this trip was for her at Cubbyhole. And while Allie was telling it, I started getting a little bit nervous because I know Allie and I know storytelling and stuff gets heightened and the beats of the jokes and everything. But I'm like, oh my gosh, I know there are going to be some people in the chat who are going to be angry about this story.
Right. Right, right, right. Yeah. Allie tells a story about flying from Chicago to New York to go to the Cubbyhole for the first time. In the story, she does go home with an older dyke who, in her telling of the story, she really exaggerates how she, like, how do I even say this?
How aggressive it was. Like, yeah, Allie views that experience as a consensual encounter.
Yes.
By every means. And Allie has had non-consensual encounters.
She's had a few of those.
And yes.
How she deals with a lot of this is through humor, too.
Yes.
But I alerted her that there were some concerned comments in the chat on our YouTube live. We weren't able to see a lot of the chat, by the way. We were on a whole other Zoom. But during her story, I was very curious because I thought maybe this could come across a little differently to someone who's not as familiar with Allie, her storytelling, or just the nuance of like heightening in stories in general. And I did see some people a little upset who were concerned that it sounded like this wasn't a consensual sexual experience that Allie had with this woman. And Allie does see it as super consensual. She was actually determined to make sure it happened. Like it was the whole point of the story was for her to have any kind of sexual relationship with a woman. And she does count it a win.
thin. It's just not ideal, but she...
Yeah. It was different than what she expected for herself for that night. And she was taken by surprise because she had never been with another woman, much less a very like aggressive, very aggressive top who took control. And it was just something that she wasn't expecting. But people in the comments and I
just a couple. Saw some.
Yeah, I saw some of them after, but they were saying that they were triggered and they were very upset and thought that people were going to be scared out of going to the cubbyhole, or that we were making it seem like lesbian bars are full of predators. Like, that's not the case at all. But an interesting thing that kind of was also happening with a different podcast was our friends at the Coming Out podcast, past guest Lauren Flans had a tweet that she wrote that had to do with the Queen's Gambit. So she had been watching the Queen's Gambit on Netflix and making some jokes about it, and wrote a tweet that said, "The orphan I adopted sucks at chess, FML," and then a like disappointed looking emoji. And it went kind of viral. And then she tweeted, "Finally, I have a joke that's so like stupid and simple that goes viral that nobody can misinterpret it and think it's not a joke." Well, with that, boy, did people come after her. And really, the discourse and like the anger at Lauren, a comedian, for this very obvious joke really got out of control. So in a reaction to that, Coming Out Pod made an episode about triggers and being triggered. And it's an really great episode. I couldn't possibly talk about everything they talk about the way that they do it. So I just want to recommend listen to that episode of Coming Out Pod about triggers and how it plays into, you know, the stuff we see online and how we react to it. And it did remind me a little bit of what went on with like Allie during the show and people being triggered. And it was just a very interesting, awesome listen. And, you know, there are trigger warnings up top to with that. It's not for everybody, but if anybody is interested, I just want to give a heads up about that.
Mm-hmm. We've always been triggered our whole lives, but now we have these labels for and it's become a whole other thing. We're living life and reacting to life. Like, it's unavoidable.
Yeah. Yeah. And you give too much power, like people were giving too much power to Lauren being like, "You are harming foster kids," with this tweet. And it's like, no, she's not. Yeah. Like, she's not, you know, and Allie isn't doing anything to, Allie isn't hurting the cubbyhole with the story.
Allie isn't a rape survivor. And, you know, she knows she's been raped and exactly what those instances look like in contrast to what this story is. She would never put it in her hour, you know, like,
yeah,
this is her art. This is her probably processing some other stuff through the humor of this story.
Right. It's not that we're telling people who were triggered by it, get over it or anything like that, but it's the comments in the chat to not kind of understand where Allie was coming from. And we just want to be really clear that, you know, Allie was telling a story that she thinks is hilarious. And I think it's hilarious. And a lot of people thought it was hilarious. And,
oh, yeah. We should mention a lot of people did think it was funny.
Yeah, yeah. Including the bar owner we had on from Aloho, A League of Her Own.
Oh, yeah.
Bar in D.C., Joe, who we hope to have on the podcast to dig out more soon, because she is a character. And that was so fun to talk to. And we only had 10 minutes with her on the Zoom. And we're like, we need to continue this and duke it out over our opinions on Jenny Schechter.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Speaking of opinions on queer culture, we did watch Happiest Season. We did just talk about it for 90 minutes.
Yeah. Speaking of triggers.
For the Patreon. Yeah. Right. So we're not going to talk about it too much here, but we did both watch it twice.
Twice each.
I enjoyed it, and then we talked about it for 90 minutes, and now I'm like, maybe I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Maybe I just enjoyed Kristen Stewart's wardrobe, and that had me so blinded to... No, I could see
something for everyone.
Right. I could see what everybody was up in arms about for sure with it. But then at the same time, I'm like, but can't we just enjoy it? You know, it's
right.
Like, does everything have to be dissected? Like, it's a holiday rom-com and like, I don't give this much, you know, like, are straight people getting upset over their representation in Hallmark movies and like deep diving? It's like, why do we have to do this to our content? But I totally get why. It's very gay for us to process.
Exactly. The fact that stories. We're all collectively coming together as dykes or queer people in yes. general and dissecting just what was toxic about this movie is
right.
the most lesbian thing I've done all week, you know? Yeah. At least it's good for queer conversation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, how the L word, for better or for worse, brings us together. And I do think I'll watch Happiest Season again. And I don't know. The quick and dirty is I think Kristen Stewart looked great.
And I think Aubrey Plaza looked delectable.
Yes. Aubrey Plaza looked phenomenal. And I was actually very impressed with Aubrey's acting in it. I thought she really nailed that part, and her flirt game was just very impressive and on point, and I loved that. I don't think that she should have ended up with Abby. I think that would be a different kind of movie. I agree with everyone that Harper sucks, and where was the grand gesture
right.
to win Abby back? And those are the bullet points from me. Also, Mary Steenburgen in that red dress, and then end of list. Melody, you fell asleep the first time watching it.
Out me for that. I did. I had just had my big Thanksgiving feast, just me and Allie, so much food. And yeah, we'd been saving it. We wanted to watch it the night before and we were afraid we would fall asleep. So we waited until the next day and I did fall right asleep. I made sure to watch it again, of course. You know, just listen to we just talked about yeah. this for so long. Please consider joining our Patreon and listening to all of our thoughts there. It yes. did rekindle my love. Before I even formally was out, I was in love with Aubrey Plaza.
Yes.
Like, she was my biggest crush. And I sort of forgot about that. And all the reminders came back once I rewatched this. Fully alert.
I can't imagine that Aubrey Plaza had any idea of the storm that she created. Like, how many follows do you think she got from people with her image as their avatar now? Like,
I know.
Like, so many lesbian
fan
accounts.
Drawings, imagine.
Yeah, yeah. The art that's going to come, the fan fiction of Abby and Riley. Like, she might have had an inkling, but there's nothing that could have prepared her for being launched into just like the object of lesbian desire everywhere mm-hmm. because of this movie.
Man. Desire in a blazer.
I think she's the new, you know, run me over with your car.
Yeah.
Person. Rachel Weisz is out. Everybody wants Aubrey Plaza to suffocate them in a blazer.
Please. And sit with me in a booth on my side, please.
Yes. Oh, the booth move.
So good.
Can anybody do the booth move anymore?
No.
Is it spoiled?
No, it's just not socially distant.
Yeah. Right. Oh, man. Oh, I know. You know, that scene made me so sad about COVID. I was like, I would love to be at that gay bar watching this drag show right now, watching this campy holiday sing-along.
They had some good drag queens, too. They had Jinx in that scene.
Yes.
Just every, so,
so
well cast. That's what we'll say.
Yes. Yes.
For the rest
well
of the
cast.
Thoughts, head to the Patreon. I mean, we did just talk at length. Mike, my throat is sore.
I know. Yeah, this week was so crazy. So it was Monday we had the show. Then I had to post the episode. I was up till like 2:30 in the morning and then had to wake up at 6:30 and drive upstate to close on our house. So, you know, spend a day on the porch of a law office in rural upstate New York. Closing. I was so tired. Then Wednesday was happiest season day. Thursday was Thanksgiving. It's just been nuts.
What have you put in the house so far?
Oh, nothing. I mean, the first thing we did after we closed on the house was we drove to Home Depot and then we got a succulent plant.
Yeah, gayest thing ever.
We're so excited. We're so happy. I met one of the neighbors the other day. We went back to the house yesterday before our Patreon hang that we had. Mm-hmm. Every other month we do a Patreon hang for patrons at the $20 month and above level, and was rushing back after spending the morning at the house trying to figure out how we could make a functional kitchen and bathroom. But I met a neighbor, and with this whole process with like looking at houses and all the people you meet and all the steps you take along the way, I'm having the anxiety of being like a lesbian couple outside of New York City. I have so much privilege in living here and being out in New York where it's no big deal coming out to people and meeting people as a couple with me and Cecilia. But then I'm like, oh, we're probably the only lesbians on the street. I don't know. Maybe we are. Like, what are the neighbors going to think? And you would think I wouldn't care. But every time I get a little bit nervous before being like, oh, this is my wife, Cecilia. You know, we were meeting with the contractor. I'm like, is he gonna be weird about this? Is the guy
coming out over and over again?
Right. Meeting the guy who was selling us the house. Like, is he going to be mad that he's selling it to lesbians, you know? And while, like, I don't care if he's mad, like, part of me still has anxiety over it. And
you need to just get a pride flag outside your house.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that does a lot of the talking.
We'll paint one of the sheds to be a rainbow, yeah. I think.
That's it.
Yeah, just get it out there. And, you know, who wouldn't want a lovely lesbian couple to be their neighbors?
I know.
We make good neighbors. We can jumpstart your car for you. We can, I don't know. No,
we can grow something in our garden.
Right. The neighbor I met was very lovely. We exchanged numbers. I'm like, this is really fun to have like neighbors that, you know, that will call on each other for for things. And yeah, it's going to be a whole different life. And we're very excited. And after our car was sideswiped on the streets of Queens today, just, you know, parked and minding its own business, Cecilia is extra anxious to leave the city now.
Yeah.
Get us out of here.
New York's little goodbye, a little parting gift for you guys.
Yeah. They're like, you think that you can just get up and move out of here? Not so fast. We're going to squeeze every last bit of misery and financial burden out of you.
Da, 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 da. I mean, is that the gayest thing you did this week? Because closing on a house upstate with your goddamn wife sounds pretty gay.
You know, I'm just having the most like gay time this whole month because I don't think that's the gayest thing. I did on Black Friday, I bought a set of power tools.
Yep.
For the new house. So that's very gay, I think, buying, you know, having that be like my first purchase for the home was like, I must buy a set of power tools. I need a drill with more amps behind it.
Yeah.
I need a circular saw. I need.
Okay. Okay, calm down.
I need both a drill and an impact driver. You know, I can't just have one anymore. It's not going to cut it. This isn't apartment living. This is country DIY cottage core lesbo life. So I got the power tools, but even more gay than that, and Melody, you can see this now, but I am wearing a plaid fleece. Cecilia and I, we kicked off the week right on Sunday, and we bought matching plaid fleeces at Old Navy. They were $10.
At Old Navy.
We walked by an Old Navy on the way to a flooring store, and I saw in the window, and I was like, plaid fleeces for $10. Yes, please. So we went in and bought matching fleeces.
Something about Old Navy is so gay. It's like so, dykey gay. Remember, Carolyn, we were writing a script, and I just put a character description, and I wrote Old Navy lesbian.
Yes.
And our teacher was like, I don't know if that's a thing, or maybe because I'm not a lesbian or in the culture, I don't know. And it's not. It's just in my mind, it's a real thing. Just an Old Navy lesbian. Molly Carney comes to mind.
When you said Old Navy lesbian, I was like, I know exactly who that is.
Yeah, it's a type.
I know what shorts they're wearing in the summer.
Yes. I know what they're layering with.
Oh, man. Yeah, so great for layers and plaids. You know, you got to get a lot of different kinds of plaids so that you can not always be matching exactly, just complementary plaids. And that's a good place for it. So now I also bought like matching pajamas and matching socks and slippers. So Cecilia and I now both have head to toe matching plaid and like different color schemes. And we're going to look like going to take the neighborhood by storm.
That's Allie's wet dream. She begs for me to match with her. And I usually just do it on special occasions or her birthday. She just always buys two of everything, hoping they'll match her at some point.
I love it. What is the gayest thing you did this week?
Oh, did I tell you that I saw a car in my neighborhood with vanity custom plates? And wait, am I allowed to tell people's custom plates on the pod? Because it's not like...
Yes, if they're going to pay for those custom plates, not only did you tell me, you showed me. And
yeah. Okay. Yeah. I took pictures and showed you. Right.
I thought you were going to tell me, though, that you like just decided to wait by the car to see. Like, I would have been hiding behind a bush with binoculars just waiting to see if you got into that car.
If I wasn't so obsessed with my Fitbit and getting my steps and making sure my heart rate is above at least that burn mode, then I would have stopped and waited. But what happened, dear listeners, is there's a car on my block with custom vanity plates that say AJ space lesbo. Okay. And it's a Honda. So I ran up to him like, no way. And of course it's a Honda Fit. I had to Google what a Honda Fit looks like. I don't know cars. Oh. It's a CRV. but it was the license plate said lesbo. So what did I do? I took a diking out card out of my back. Pack, and I put it on their on the under windshield. Their windshield wiper.
Oh my god!
And took pictures and quickly showed you. And I, on the way back from my walk, I went to the park and came back. They were still there. And then the next morning, I went for another walk, and they're not there. So this person could very well be listening to this right now.
That's what I was thinking. I'm like AJ lesbian or AJ lesbo,
AJ lesbo of Central Brooklyn. Reach out. I want to know if it worked. I've never handed anyone a card. I've never had the opportunity to. We got our cards right before lockdown. So this is the first time I've given out a card, and it was perfectly for AJ Lesbo, the car.
Other than your sister's bike shop.
Oh, that's true. I did leave
you
a stack there. Yeah.
Yeah. But this was very like targeted.
Yeah.
I love your targeted marketing, Melody.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm so impressed by it. And this is like the funniest thing to me. I can't like imagine, because I would think like that maybe they forget that their plate says AJ Lesbo.
Right.
Like that's not the first thing that comes to mind. So to go to your car and find something on it that's like decking out, be like, how did they know? And they're like, oh yeah, oh, AJ yeah. Lesbo.
AJ Lesbo, if you're listening, please reach out. I want to know if it worked. Because if it does work, I'm just going to keep taking out stacks of cards with me on my walks. I get to leave my apartment every so often for these walks. I'm not going to just stop at Vanity Plates. I'm going to go to
Honda
things
Fits.
With a little more nuance. Maybe I'm just going to go up to, you know, a shoe store in the neighborhood. And I'm going to put them in some utility boots. Anywhere I can reach new listeners.
Yes, I'll go back to Old Navy and put it in the fleece plaids for $10.
That's where you put them in.
Right. Why didn't I think of it? I need to carry them on me as well. I think that if you had a Honda Fit, you wouldn't need the custom plate to say AJ right. Lesbo. It just screams AJ Lesbo. I wonder if AJ is like the name or if AJ stands for something like...
Or if it's like Allison and Jamie, like...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I'm thinking like a jaunty Lesbo or...
a jacked Lesbo.
Ooh, a jacked Lesbo, yeah. oh my gosh. AJ Lesbo, if you're listening, can you just email a picture of yourself to dykingout@gmail.com? I'm so curious.
So many questions, but...
Also, feel free to send us a paragraph about your life story and what led you up to the point of making that custom plate.
Yes, yes, yes.
I so need curious. To know.
So that was it.
Well, I think it is time to get into our interview that I was excited about. Oh, man.
Gayest thing of the year for me, this conversation.
I know. This is somebody who has been on the list for diking out dream guests from the beginning. So today we do have the privilege of diking out with Jamie Babbitt, whose film But I'm a Cheerleader is being re-released as a director's cut with a few extra scenes and in 4K Ultra HD on December 8th. Mark your calendar for that. It will be available. There's going to be extra content, commentary, behind the scenes, and some shorts of Jamie, so check that out. Jamie is also known for her movies Itty Bitty Titty Committee and Addicted to Fresno, which also stars Aubrey Plaza playing queer.
Hello.
And Jamie has directed episodes of every one of my favorite TV shows. Every one of them.
Every
There's not a TV show that I love that Jamie hasn't
show.
Directed an episode of.
Her IMDb is a true revelation.
Yes.
I knew she'd done a lot, but I really had no idea until researching for this conversation.
I
She's
know.
She's done
I was
it
like,
all.
Wonderfalls. Wonderfalls is on the list.
Popular.
Okay. Yes. so many shows. So let's get into it. Jamie Babbitt, lesbian icon and true hero of the queer community. Thank you for diking out with us today.
I love diking out. Let's do it.
Thank you, Jamie. We are such big fans, and we could start, like a lot of interviews with you, probably start by just listing your IMDb page, but we only have an hour of your time. So I'd love to start instead by asking first, what is the gayest thing you did this last week? We ask all of our guests.
I mean, the gayest thing I did this week is have sex with my girlfriend, obviously.
I tried to say that. Carolyn said sex didn't count. We had to be more creative.
Well, because we have to do it every
week.
That's true. So if we said sex every week.
We can count your sex.
Yeah, guess sex is fine.
Okay, thanks. It's just so gay. So, you know.
It's the gayest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're also wearing stripes right now, which I consider gay.
Cool.
Right? Can we say right now, stripes are gay?
Oh, yeah.
Is that a thing?
And
okay.
You know we're talking to a dykon right now because I did sweat. I had brow sweat over what I was going to wear. I was like, should I wear a hat? No, what? I never. I tried to find my Luke's Diner shirt in your honor. Unfortunately, it's dirty. I do wear it a lot. So.
Love it. Although I will say, having directed 18 episodes of Gilmore Girls, Luke's Diner was always a stressful shoot, I will say, because those two actors did not really get along.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. I could already imagine it being a tense set with the dense script.
Yes.
So Oof. That on top of it sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of paragraphs to get through. I've never looked at a Gilmore Girls script, but I'm sure it's got some heft to it.
Yeah, it's a lot for the poor actors. And it's all word perfect. So they, you know, they're getting it.
Right.
And it's like, okay, you have to get every and the but.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a lot of dialogue.
So much.
So, yeah.
The first question I want to ask you is that for like a whole generation of dykes and lesbians, But I'm a Cheerleader is one of the first, if not the first, gay movie that a lot of us were exposed to, I think, especially around my age. I want to know, what's the first gay movie that you saw?
It's funny. The reason I made By a Cheerleader is because there were no good gay movies when I was around, when I was a youngster. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, first gay movie I saw was probably Incredibly True Adventure of Two Girls in Love. But I saw that about 5 minutes before I made But I'm a Cheerleader.
Nice.
Well, so. I guess that is kind of why But I'm a Cheerleader is the first one for a lot of us.
Canon.
Yeah.
Right. I remember, like, I was so young when it came out that, like, I couldn't go out and see it anywhere or buy it. So I was just, like, on Kazaa just trying to download the scene of Clea and Natasha together. Just trying to find a file that wasn't going to eat my computer.
Oh, man. I know exactly where it was in our Blockbuster. I can tell you exactly, like, what corner of the Blockbuster and what shelf it was on. I love it.
Did you guys know it was a gay movie based on, because the cover you couldn't really tell, or could you?
No, I had no idea. And I actually, that made for an awkward sleepover with my friends. We rented it in high school. We kind of thought it'd be like a Clueless, and it is like a gay Clueless. But I had no idea it was going to be gay, and because it's still super closeted. So I had to later in life rent it and like thoroughly watch it on my own.
Did your friends like it, or were they like, oh God, everyone's gay? Or were they like, oh yeah, it was fine?
They really liked it. We all liked a lot of campy stuff back then. Yeah. So that was perfect.
Great. I was a huge Clueless fan. So that was definitely one of the movies that marked me as a kid, like watching that movie. I was like, oh, I want to make a movie like that. So then in my 20s, like early 20s, I was like, I want to make a gay movie like that.
Yes.
Incredibly True Adventure of Two Girls in Love. I really liked it because it was also kind of a romantic comedy that was really fun. But I liked just the colorful nature of Clueless. And
yeah,
I wanted to do something that kind of wasn't set in reality. It was a little more pushed into fantasy.
Right.
Yeah.
It was like a Riot Girl Clueless mix somehow.
Yeah. which kind of sounds like me. Yeah. Yeah. So.
And then for me, I know that I was just like researching anything I could about like lesbian and lesbian culture on the internet when I was coming out. And that was like the one movie that kept coming up like over and over. I'm like, what is this movie? I need to see it. I want to know, how did you come up with the idea to use Natasha Lyonne as a tool to recruit lesbians? And do you get residuals every time she appears gay in a project that you're not involved in?
I do not, but I did make fun on, we were laughing about it on Russian Doll when we were working together. And I said, you know, Natasha, thank you so much for basically playing me in my story and being a part of my imagination in But I'm a Cheerleader. And now it's so cool, you know, 20 years later to go into your imagination and direct your world and your fantasy and your story. Because Russian Doll is so personal to her. Mm-hmm. So I was like, we've done this really intimate, like creative share with each other, which is so cool. And I said, and let's also remember, I did make you a gay icon. You're welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And she's like, yeah, but I'm straight. I'm like, I know. Well, sure. But you still love lesbians. And she's like, oh yeah, I do. But like, if I was a lesbian, I'd be cleaning up. I'm like, I know.
Oh yeah. Big time.
Yeah. I recently put the question out there of, how many times does a straight actress play gay until they are a lesbian icon? And someone said, as many times as Natasha Lyonne.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. So, I mean, I would define, the one thing I love about your generation and the generation below you guys is just the whole concept of queer has really caught on. And it's just such a better way to talk about people because Natasha is the ultimate queerdo. Yeah. So she's just very queer. She's not totally straight, but you know, she probably is like romantically and sexually more interested in men, but she's definitely a queerdo. So queerdo for life, you know.
And she's got the energy.
Yeah.
And then her character in the movie played a very, you know, goody two shoes Christian, I believe, cheerleader who is clearly gay, but there are a lot of times where she's very over the top. What comes to mind, especially, is her makeout scenes with her boyfriend. really conveyed visually a feeling there. Was that something you had in mind for the character, or did she bring that? Did it evolve into that?
It's funny. I never pictured the makeout scene with the boyfriend in the car. We actually shot that the first day.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And you can see one problem I had on the first day was her wig. It just looked way too blonde and it looked a lot like a wig. So if you watch it again, you'll see like the opening cheerleader scenes. She's wearing this like really long blonde wig in the high school and stuff. And then later it gets slightly browner and a little more like realistic. But she's wearing that bad wig in the makeout with the boyfriend. And I did never expected her to be that funny when like her eyes bugging out while she was making out with him. But I was so delighted. Like I was just at Video Village watching it on the monitor going, I never would have pictured it being like this, but I'm so happy. It's so weird and cool. And she's so funny.
Yeah.
It kind of sets the tone for a lot of the humor, I think, in the rest of the movie. But yeah, that part definitely.
Yeah. And even her like ridiculous cheerleading. I mean, she like went to yeshiva. She's like, is like, yo, Jamie, what's up? And then she's playing a cheerleader 1 second later, like, kill the Rangers, you know? It was just like really funny being on set too, watching her channel what in her idea was a Ohio cheerleader, which I actually, to be fair, was not a cheerleader. I was like a theater dork, but I've always had like a sunny disposition and I am from Ohio and I would consider myself a femme as far as lesbians go. Mm-hmm. So I could pass as straight, which is kind of a curse in a way, especially in high school. So those were all the things I wanted to talk about in the film. And Natasha really, you know, read the script and sort of studied me and was like, oh, you're like, she used to call me Nancy Kerrigan.
Oh my God.
So yeah, she just channeled that like positivity and, you know, and that was her character choice.
When you said before that that was kind of like a little bit based on you, like, were you that obviously gay but oblivious to it, do you think?
Yes, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I kind of knew, but not really. I didn't really know any femme lesbians. I just knew butch lesbians. So I was like just confused about myself because I thought, well, I'm terrible at sports. I'm like scared of all the like field hockey, like lacrosse, like brutish lesbian girls.
Relatable.
Yeah. So I was like, am I gay? Like I'm hot for my friends, but like, I don't, yeah, I just was confused. I was like, was I supposed to be butch, but I'm terrible. Like I couldn't figure it out. So.
Do you remember what direction you gave to Natasha for the end of the movie cheer scene to win Clea back?
So what's funny about that scene is originally it was an actual cheer where she did like a cartwheel and some like basic cheerleading stuff. And it was so bad. And she has no idea how to do anything related to cheerleading. And so I shot that day and it was obviously based on that sequence. You can see I had a lot of people to deal with. It was like a big scene, a big scene, a big scene.
Right.
So the worst part of that scene was Natasha's cheer. It was terrible. And my editor called me and she said, Jamie, you've got to reshoot Natasha's performance because it's just really bad. And it's not her fault. Like, did you give her cheerleading lessons? I'm like, no, I guess I just thought she could do it. But like, you actually have to go to like cheer camp and you guys have seen the documentary. Oh, yeah. Like you have to work your ass off. Yeah. Like intense. Natasha's like from New York. She went to yeshiva. Like she can't do any of that.
She's no Ladaria.
So I said to my editor, I'm like, okay, well, what should I do? And she's like, why don't you just shoot a close up of Natasha and just change it? Instead of it being a cheer, make it like spoken word, really like thoughtful kind of poetry. And just like intense and emotional and forget about like actual cheerleading. And I'm like, okay, you're right. You're right. Like Natasha can do that. So I said to the financier, I'm like, okay, sorry, I need to reshoot just Natasha. And he's like, you know, that's so expensive. We can't go back. And I said, okay, how about if I literally just have Natasha and I'll just do a close-up of Natasha. No one else will be there. I'll put a piece of tape on a C-stand that she can look at and pretend it's Clea. And I'll just shoot her. So if you watch the sequence, you can see in Natasha's close-up, the tree behind her has no leaves on it. And when I shot the actual scene, the tree has leaves on it. Because it was like a month later that I shot it.
Oh my God.
That's so funny.
And I just, you know, Natasha's a really good actress. And so I just reconceptualized it and just said, okay, Natasha, it's like spoken word. Just say it really intensely. Like when she's like, I love you. And like, this is fate. Like all that. She was literally talking to a piece of tape. Like no one was there.
Amazing.
No one was there.
Yeah. It's so like tender and emotional. I love it.
Oh man.
Yeah. Guys, the magic of filmmaking. It was that music and it was total bullshit. Yeah. It was, thank God I pulled that out of my ass. There was a lot of like crazy saves in that movie. And that's the thing about filmmaking that's really fun, but also really hard is that there are times where you just totally fuck up a scene, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was one shot, one performance that I did not get. I just did a bad job and it was my fault. And you know, other sometimes in some cases, I think filmmakers are like, well, it's I did it. And so it must be brilliant. And now I'm going to put it in the movie. But I was like, I've always questioned myself enough to be like, oh, right, it's terrible. I need to make it better. And I'm okay. And I actually think that's like a gift of being a woman, that we're like more open to things being a process rather than like, I'm brilliant. Let's just, it's perfect.
Yeah,
you know, like I'm willing to work hard. Yeah. So I was like, you're right. It totally sucks. I have to fix it. And thank God, because the movie would not work without that. So
thank
God. That was a save. But I also had Natasha and I also got to go for one shot. And, you know, there was a lot of things I had to fight for, but I did get that. So that was great.
Yeah. You have to, I think, strike a balance between that impulse to like correct and make sure you got it right, but then to like let things go and not obsess over things that you don't even try in the first place.
Exactly.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
And then Clea. Can you tell us about how you started working with her? We know she acted in a short you had that came out before, But I'm a Cheerleader. But as far as like how you met, in our minds, you met in a very Planet-esque cafe in L.A.
Yes.
Art, seriously?
True.
Because like that's how I picture it, at least. How did she come into your life?
Yeah. So there was a, there literally was a cafe. So Clea is like a generation under me, but she had like graduated from high school early, was living on her own, had two jobs, had like a whole life set up. So even though I was older than her, I think I was like 25 when I met her and she was 18, 17, something like that. She had her whole life. And one of her jobs she had was at a coffee shop. And every time I went to the coffee shop, she was so cute. And she'd be like, do you want a free cappuccino? And like would serve me and give me free shit. So we talked and she was like, yeah, I just graduated from high school and I want to be an actor. And I was like, oh, I just moved to LA. I want to be a director. Do you have an agent? And she did at the time, but it was like some really weird agent who only represented the woman who was in the Where's the Beef commercial.
Are you serious? Just her. Not even the Grey Poupon like guy. Clea. Just.
No. It was the Where's the Beef lady and Clea.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, well, I'm going to make a short film, but I need to like get a job and make some money first and you should be in it. And she was like, okay, cool. And so I wrote a short film that was based on the Sleeping Beauty's fairy tale. And I was like, Clea's a perfect Prince Charming because she's so cute. And she is like, she's just like a little cowboy, you know, gentleman stud. And so, but I was nervous because it had taken me like a really hard job and a lot of stress to raise the money for the short. So I was like, I mean, she's cute and all, and she's gives great, you know, I get all this free coffee, but like, can she really act? I don't know. And so I took myself really seriously, obviously, because I was like, I need this short to like start my career. And so I made her come to my apartment and audition for the part, but the part, the name was Clea in the script. And Clea was so mad at me. She was furious. She was like, we're friends. I can't believe you're making me audition. This is such bullshit. And I was like, look, I'm a professional director. Like, I need to know if you can act. I don't know if you can or not. And so it was like kind of a weird moment in our friendship. And by the way, she was terrible in the audition. Really? She was so nervous. And she was just like yelling at me the whole time.
I'd probably be most nervous for auditioning for a friend.
Yeah, of course. So she was really nervous. But after the audition, I was like, the cool thing about Clea, she just underplays everything, which is the easiest thing for a film director. Because when people underplay, it always comes across as real. The hardest thing is people who overplay, which is like sucks because it's a lot of kids who come out of kid acting. They really encourage you to overact, or like theater people because they encourage you to overact. But Clea was so perfect because she had been raised in LA and the only acting classes she had taken were like acting for film.
Right. Yeah.
So she was really small. And I was like, okay, well, that's great. At least she's not like overacting. But she kept hiding her face with her hands while we were doing the audition. And I'm like, Clea, I can't even see your face. She's like, well, I'm hiding because I'm really nervous. I'm like, it's literally a medium of your face. Like you have to take your hands out of your face. Anyway, she's always been like my kid sister where I'm like yelling at her and she's like being a brat back. So that dynamic remains until today.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Did you have any advice for her in her directing endeavor with The Happiest Season? Did you talk to her throughout that at all?
We did talk about it, but it's funny. I feel like she's was other people she showed the film to and got comments and stuff. And I always like left myself open for that where I was like, Clea, I'm happy to talk to you. I'm happy to give you notes. And she never did. I think it's because I make her nervous, honestly. So I'll be seeing it with the rest of the world on Thanksgiving weekend that I can't wait. Yeah.
Seriously.
Yes. So you're re-releasing But I'm a Cheerleader, but a director's cut, and it's 20 years later. What was that like to revisit the movie in that way?
It was really cool because I actually got a phone call from Lionsgate, and they said, you know, there's some movies in our catalog. One is American Psycho. One is But I'm a Cheerleader, that like we don't have, we never did a good release of the film. And so it's like hard to find, and it doesn't have DVD extras, and it's just, it's not like a great quality transfer. So they were like, you know, over time, certain movies just kind of stick out, and we realized we didn't really do them justice. And yours is one of those films. And I was like, that's so awesome that you guys are going to do a better job at just keeping it in the archive. So they were like, you know, we want to do a 4K. So I shot it in film, you know, in 2000. So it's been, they had to do like a lot of digital work on the print and, you know, a lot of stuff, but so much better for preservation for the film too, to just have like better sound. Yeah. So they invested a lot of money in the movie, which is exciting. And then they said, well, look, now that we're going to be preserving it in a better way and re-releasing it, would you like to put any scenes back in the film, since we have to go back to all the negative and everything anyway? And I was like, you know what? There was always a couple scenes that I regret cutting out of the film. One of them was my favorite scene, which was when Kathy Moriarty's character is playing music for all the rehabbers.
Yes.
And the reason it's one of my favorite scenes is because when I was growing up, so the movie's kind of autobiographical in that my mom ran a rehab, and it was a drug and alcohol rehab, but it was also for kids. And our house was like the one town over, and we spent all our holidays there. And like, I was raised and spent a ton of time at this rehab. And my mom would always have like guitar, sit around the fire with all of the residents and like sing songs. And I remember when I got older in college and I heard a Joni Mitchell song, I thought that the lyrics to it were, I've looked at drugs from both sides now, but still somehow it's drug delusions I recall. I really don't like drugs at all. Because when I was growing up, that's what my mom always sang. And I was so confused that that actually wasn't the lyrics of the song.
That's so,
so
funny.
I was like, I have to put a scene like that in But I'm a Cheerleader where they learn like a regular song, but it has new lyrics that have to do with like, you know, getting better from being gay. So, I mean, and it has no plot point, so I know why I cut it out long ago, but it's a short little scene and it just meant a lot to me. And so I was so glad to put it back in the film.
Yeah. I love that. That was a nice little payoff moment.
Are you doing commentary on the DVD?
Yes. Yes. So we did, I did, well, that was also really fun. We did actors. It was COVID, so it was perfect because everyone was available.
Oh, yeah.
So we did actors commentary with like 15 of the actors, which was great. Just like a lot of them who don't even, they're not even acting anymore. They're doing like other cool jobs. And one of the actors, Kathy Moriarty, had never seen the film. And she literally just saw it before we did the DVD commentary.
She'd never seen it?
She'd never seen it.
Who is she? Adam Driver?
Come on. Yeah, she'd never seen it. And it was actually a gay friend of hers was like, you haven't seen it? It's so good. It's a classic. You got to watch it. And she was like, yeah, it was pretty good. Jamie was pretty good. I was like, wow. We have a fan like 20 years later. But yeah, it was really cool. And then we also did a DVD commentary that was just the creative team. So it was me, the production designer, and the costume designer, which was fun because that was such a huge part of the movie was the design of the film. And the three of us just had a really good rapport. So it was remembering kind of how we came to the look of the film, which was really great. And then they also included in the new release some short films of mine, which is pretty funny.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Does that include the one with
Clea? You know, they couldn't do that, but you can see it online at jamiebabbitt.com. I put it up on my website. But it's my inspiration for the short that Clea was in. And I think it's on YouTube also. It's just look up Sleeping Beauties, Jamie Babbitt. But I'm sure it's a crappy version. But
that won't stop any lesbian from
watching. No, I know. And Clea's so cute in it. It's so cute. It's Rose McGowan plays the dead woman, and Clea gets is the Prince Charming. But and it was at Sundance, I think like 2 years before Cheerleader or something. And it looked really beautiful. I shot it in film also. It was similar in like the colors and the stylized thing that I was doing in Cheerleader was the short for sure. But the big inspiration for the short film was this Disney music, the like 1940s, really weird. I'm wishing. Like that really weird, like princess music. And so that's all over the movie. And clearly Disney's never giving me the rights for that music. But I love that music. It's so weird and creepy. And like, I couldn't imagine the film with any other music. So I was like, well, I'll never sell it or be able to put it anywhere, but I could just release it on the internet and then no one, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get this DVD because I actually want to ask you about the look and feel and how, like, because it has a very distinct, campy pink look to it. I wanted to know, like, what inspired that and, like, if you remember the descriptors you said to the costume designer, the art department for that.
Yeah. I mean, I was inspired by some movies that we all watched together. So there was a French movie called My Life in Pink. Mon Vie en Rouge, and it was about, I think today you would say, a gender nonconforming kid who lives in like a pink fantasy land, and it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
So I definitely gave that to the designer, and then I was really inspired by Edward Scissorhands, like the suburban.
That's what the vibe that it gave me. Yeah.
But that was like a, you know, $50 million movie, and we had like $1 million, so it was like on the cheap. And then there was this other gay filmmaker. He did this movie called Pink Narcissus, which is really beautiful. It's like porn, kind of. It was like gay porn. I mean, it's definitely like hardcore porn, but in this really like stylized world. It's such a cool mix of like two genres. So that was a big influence too. And the director of Pink Narcissus is this guy, James Bidgood. So yeah, I was like inspired by a lot of queer artists, honestly. And I was inspired by the Barbie Dreamhouse.
Oh yeah.
So I gave the Barbie Dreamhouse to the designer and I said, like, I want New Directions to, or True Directions to look like the Barbie Dreamhouse. Because that to me was such a perfect emblem of conforming to your gender.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what the ridiculousness of the movie. I was just trying to say, like, just because you're more feminine, more masculine, doesn't mean that you're any less gay. Because that's what was so confusing to me, because I was always like a girly girl and I loved Barbies and I loved like all that stuff. But then I was like super gay too. So I wanted to kind of poke fun at all that stuff.
And when you were asked to revisit the film, how long had it been since you last watched it?
You know, I think I had watched it the year before because they screened it in Brooklyn at some cool theater that they invited me to. And I was like, oh, I don't know. It's hard sometimes for filmmakers to watch their own films because you just see like all the mistakes and stuff. But I did go because my daughter was in town and she's 15. And I was like, have you ever seen But I'm a Cheerleader? And she was like, no. I was like, all right, well, it's playing in Brooklyn. Do you want to go? And she was like, not really. And I was like, Mom, you know, let's just go and you can see it. And so I brought her to see it. And I think it was, I don't know, she'll never tell me, but I think it was probably inspiring just because it was sold out. It was like so many cool queer people that were so excited about it.
I was going to say it probably upped your cool factor with her. Yeah. She's like, ugh, my mom's cool.
Yeah, but like she was kind of annoyed too. Like, ugh, why? You know, I don't know. But yeah, I think, and then afterwards I was like, did you like it? And she was like, I did. I liked it. It was good. So, you know, that's what I get.
What were some of the challenges you came across in trying to make this movie in 1999 when there really weren't studios putting out movies like that, people investing any money?
I mean, the good thing about me is that I really was so young and I really hated the studio system at the time. Even though I loved Clueless, I just had no faith that that system was ever going to give me a career or money or give a shit about anything I had to do. So I was really like grossed out by Hollywood, and I was really into Riot Girl music, and I was really into indie film community. So there were a lot of cool filmmakers like Todd Haynes, and his short Superstar I had seen, which is like, if you guys haven't seen that, look at that on YouTube. If you look up Superstar, it's a Barbie version. He used actual Barbies to tell the story of Karen Carpenter and her gay brother and her, like, you know, death from anorexia. And yeah. It's so weird and so cool. And so I was just like really inspired by like underground indie films. And I was living in New York and really into like Riot Girl underground music. And I was just kind of like, the status quo is so lame and like sexist and they're never going to help me. So fuck those people. And so when I made the short and went to Sundance with it, I felt very empowered by all of the young 20-something directors that were just doing it without needing approval from some stupid studio system. And my girlfriend was part of the kind of LA queer filmmaking scene, and she had produced Greg Araki's movies in LA. So there was definitely like a weird arty underground. And at Sundance with Sleeping Beauties, I met the financier who gave me the money for Cheerleader. And he saw the short and he really liked it. And he really liked Clea. And I was like, hey, he was like, I'm starting a film company. I like worked at Prudential Insurance last year, but now I want to get into the film business. And he was like, you know, in his 30s, so old. And I said, well, how about, you know, you see this short and I could do a movie like this with Clea, and let's just be in the festival next year with like a feature film, which would be so cool. And we'd help us both. And he was like, oh, that'd be great. Do you have a script? And I'm like, yeah, I do. And so that was But I'm a Cheerleader. And I think a lot of filmmakers have moments like that with people, and if they're, people are kind of full of shit and don't actually have the money, but right. He really did. I mean, he was like a investment banker from right near Greenwich, Connecticut. And he really wanted to get into the film business. So he was like, you know, how much money do you need? And I said, well, I think like 500,000, I could make a movie for that. And he was like, okay, cool. And so as soon as I got back from that Sundance, we started, you know, casting and started doing the whole thing. And then once we got Clea, who was obviously my friend at this point, she was friends with Natasha. So that's how we got Natasha. And then, you know, we just started auditioning people. And so then it was Kathy Moriarty and RuPaul and all these different people. And then I said to the financier, he was like a straight, you know, kind of banker bro, but very cool. And I said, hey, you know, I appreciate the 500, but I actually think I'm going to need more because now all these people are not going to get like dressed in the car and stuff. Like, I feel like we have to give them like a professional environment. And he was like, okay, like, I obviously can give you more money and I'm happy to do it, but it's just more risk for me. So if I like spend more money, then I would just want to take more of the risk on, in which case, like if the movie does really well, I would get more, you would get less. And I was like, you know what? I don't care about like making money on this movie. I really just want a career and I just want to make the film. So like, that's totally fine. And I don't regret that. I think that was a really smart decision. And I'm so happy the movie got made. I will say I have never received one penny for the film.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's not like it was like union or
no. So anything. I've never gotten a penny from it. Never one penny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But full career.
Exactly. So, and I got to make the movie I wanted to make. And he said to me, look, I'll never tell you how to make the film, but you can't tell me how to do the business side of it. And I was like, no, absolutely. Like, you're a businessman. I get it. You do your thing and I'm going to do my thing. And he was very true to his word. Wow. Like, he did not fuck with me at all creatively. Like, he was just very supportive.
Pretty ideal.
Yeah. Except for like, I see it on HBO and I mean, you know, and they're re-releasing it and I know it's done very well for him, which I'm happy for him. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, well, it would have been great if I had gotten like a dollar or if I even like didn't have to buy my own DVD from Amoeba, you know?
Oh, man. And what was the reception like initially? Like, was it on the radar enough that you had like angry moms?
Or angry queers, because it does poke
more
fun
that,
at
more
the,
that. Yeah, more that. No, I don't think it was on the radar enough. I mean, I got an NC-17. I think that was just a very conservative environment at the time that didn't like the lesbian stuff in it.
Yeah.
Which was annoying. So that was annoying. The rating was really annoying. But I got a lot of flack from the queer community, a lot. And most of the reviewers in 2000 were older gay men who had been like traumatized by AIDS.
Yeah.
And the whole queer community was really traumatized by that plague. It was so awful. And everyone had lost their friends and just no one was laughing. And so then there's this like weird young lesbian coming in making a comedy where I'm like making fun of the community. And they were really angry. Like I got the meanest reviews I've ever read at Sundance. Terrible. I was really shocked because I was so out of the... I didn't have friends that were like older gay men who had been like, you know, devastated by the community and everything, all the terrible things that had happened. So I understand why they were angry, but I felt like it was really misdirected. Like I was like, I'm the new generation. Like I want to laugh at our community. I'm in the community.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, it was just, and also I think a lot of gay men didn't really give a shit that it was a lesbian movie because they didn't care, you know? And I think a lot of young gay women loved it, but they had no power. Like they were like me in their 20s. So none of them were reviewers. So I would go to film festivals and it would be like teenagers and like girls my age, like around the block to see the movie and like crying and like going nuts for it. And then I would read these reviews that were like, pieces of shit, this movie sucks, this, fuck this, it's so offensive. And I'm like, wait, what? I don't get it. And I just realized I had like really hit a nerve. Like I have never read an F review in Entertainment Weekly before. If you look up my review of But I'm a Cheerleader, when it came out, I got an F. That's not like a C.
What?
That's
I'm
an
sorry
F.
To laugh.
Like,
I'm going to look it up.
It was so terrible. And that
I don't
guy
care who
is,
wrote it. That's homophobic.
Well, I please say something because I feel like reviewers need to go after reviewers. It's so annoying. But that guy is a head reviewer at Variety now. Like these people are around.
That's insane. Yeah. I would have thought too that gay men would have just appreciated the camp factor of it.
No, they were like, how dare you? You wish you were John Waters and like, oh, and it's a happy ending. Like, that's not what John Waters does. I'm like, I'm not trying to be John Waters. Okay. I'm my own person. Like, give me a break.
The happy ending in a lesbian film is actually revolutionary.
I mean, in my point
nobody
of view,
died.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't kill themselves. What a concept. Yeah. So I don't know. But luckily, I was kind of over everyone anyway. So I was like, well, who cares? Like everyone's always, I don't really like anything that the mainstream is doing. So if the mainstream hates me, that's fine. I don't care. Yeah. So I just kept going and I'm so glad I did.
Well, you direct a lot of mainstream type stuff now. What excites you about an opportunity when you get one? Like what are the things that really make you light up?
I mean, obviously I really like directing queer content. So I just directed the pilot for A League of Their Own that's going to be on Amazon.
Okay, I got goosebumps. You have to say the title.
Yeah. So, and Abby Jacobson and Roberta, anyway, it's like a very, it's lots of leses all over it.
Roberta Calindres?
Yes, from Vita, and Darcy Carden from The Good Place.
So yeah,
and,
she's so great.
Anyway, there's so many amazing queer performers in it. But I had a great time working on that project, and they greenlit it. So it's going to be a series on Amazon released next year.
That's amazing.
But it's
we've been excited for it
for
a while.
It's so good. Yeah. And it's like we got like real like make out scenes with the girls. It's like all the scenes you wanted to see in the original, but you never got to.
Right.
In the show, that's like the whole show is about kind of the queerness of the league, which is all totally based in reality because all of the women that we spoke to and still speak to that are alive from the league are like, yeah, like 70% of the league were lesbians. They were all hooking up. Like now everyone's coming out that they're in their 90s.
Right. Yeah. They just had that Netflix documentary about it that Ryan Murphy produced.
Yeah, which is so great. And that's like a lot of the women we've talked to who were big inspirations for a lot of the plot lines, like the affairs with the fans, the affairs with girls from other teams, the affairs with the girls who had husbands at home. So these were like a bunch of queer girls finding each other from, you know, small towns across America coming together. And it was like a total gay fun festival. So that was super fun to do. But honestly, the other project I'm in Connecticut right now working on is Steve Martin wrote it. And it's Martin Short, Steve Martin, Nathan Lane.
Oh, wow.
Tina Fey. Like, it's a big group of really incredible actors. So I like actors. I like, you know, I just like directing. It's super fun. And I like working with actors. I like shows that are really visual. Like, one of the best things about Marvelous Mrs. Maisel is just the big scope and the visual fun. I've always been interested in the like set design and just the visual wonder that you can do with movies.
Yeah, especially and, that show.
Yeah, that it's show gorgeous. Is so great. And it's like anything I think I want to shoot, I can shoot it. Like they'll support you and they'll let you do it. Yeah. It's so great. Which usually they're like, oh, that's really expensive. Do we have to do it like that? And it's like, no, we don't have to, but it's so cool. Let's do it, you know?
Yeah.
So I get excited about a visual opportunity and opportunity with actors. And then of course my heart is queer stuff. Like I love doing that stuff too. So, and I frankly, at this point in my career, am really enjoying doing TV because there's more money in it and also more people see it. Yeah. And I feel like the movies that I've made even recently, I have a movie coming out at the same time as the 20th anniversary of But I'm a Cheerleader. A movie I made last year with Drew Barrymore. And it's movies, they just, you know, I mean, obviously in COVID, it's totally dead. But I feel like that whole system is very different now. And TV is more exciting and more hands-off.
Is this the one where Drew Barrymore is a bisexual?
She's not a bisexual.
Okay, sorry. Oh, we were talking about something else.
No.
I described it to Melody. I said it's starring bisexual Drew Barrymore, but not that her character is bisexual. That
she
Drew
is,
Barrymore
yeah,
is an out bisexual.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, because she knows I love Drew Barrymore, so I thought you were telling me about a role in which she plays a bisexual.
No. Anybody who's bisexual, I say that before their name.
I see.
Yeah, just for bi visibility.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Darcy Cardin, bi visibility as well.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that until some deep Googling recently.
Yeah.
Actually, when I saw that she was involved in A League of Their Own, I was like, is she?
Yeah. Anyone attached?
Great.
Yeah.
How has your directorial style evolved over the years?
I mean, I definitely have gotten more loose about just being able to watch a scene in rehearsal and know how to shoot it in my head. Where I feel like when I was younger, I didn't have the skill to do that. So I would have to prepare a lot more beforehand because I couldn't see the shots in my head. Now I like think in shot construction, which is great to be able to be like so well-versed in filmmaking that I can like see the way it will visually play out piece by piece. So that has changed. I think I'm probably a mix of be prepared, but also let the magic come because you just don't know. And I think most directors are control freaks, but the truth is if you control it too much, then it can lose its magic. Like you also have to let people bring what they have and be surprised by things. Just like in life, it's like, you know, it's good to have a plan and like try to do stuff that you want to do. But also be aware that like an opportunity could literally be right in front of your face. And if you're just so worried about the plan in your head, you won't see it. So just trying to be relaxed on set so that you can like feel the opportunity that's happening right there and be able to capture it. So I think I've gotten more relaxed just because I'm more comfortable because it's like now it's been 20 years of just sitting on set all day. So I also think I've gotten nicer, to be honest. I think I was like a little tougher in the beginning, mostly just because I was so controlling and like nervous that I wasn't going to have a career. And I think there was like a certain kind of pressure on like a young woman that people are like, oh, you're an extra, like go to, you know, this part of the studio. I'm like, no, I'm the director. Like, fuck you. You know? So I was just always a little worried that people weren't taking me seriously. So I felt like I had to be more kind of in charge, or now I'm just like, it's fine. Like people will like listen to me. I'm not like worried about it. So, so I feel like I've gotten nicer, which is good. And I think, yeah, it would be interesting to talk to crew people to see what they would say. But, my mom was like, she was a doctor and she ran the rehab, and she was very controlling and very good at her job, but, and her patients really loved her, but she was pretty tough. So I know I have that in me for sure. Like it becomes very natural to me to like order people around and stuff. And I know it because I would watch my mom growing up, and she was so, it was so easy to, for her to order a lot of people around.
It feels like a What About Bob situation. They would come over your house, her patients, and
oh like... yeah. No boundaries, baby. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, no boundaries, no boundaries. Yeah, my mom wanted to give her staff the holidays off, so she would invite all the patients to our house for the holidays.
Oh, wow.
That's seems like, yeah, like a childhood rich with stories.
Yeah, well, I used to always say, like, I would walk through my hallways in high school, and like the most sketched out kids, like really fucked up kids that you could see were like barely getting by. They were like so drugged out. I knew they were going to be at my house at Christmas.
Were you also trying to clock who the queer people were? I feel like that would be me. I'd be like, are any of
these
guys?
Not the rehab kids. I was like the rehab kids. It was very dark, you know, addiction is really hardcore. I think the queer kids I was surrounded by in theater, like I, you know, that's,
oh, that's right.
Yeah. Like I ate lunch in the theater room and it was like, you know, the 20 gay kids, we were all there. Right. Yeah.
In terms of queer narratives, whether it's like TV or movies, is there anything that you're just like tired of seeing or stuff you want to see more of?
I mean, I'm very interested in subversive things. So I'm like interested in, like, I loved that Jane Campion movie, The Piano, about like basically a woman who gives sex to learn how to play the piano, but kind of loves it.
Yeah.
And it's like erotic, you know? And then there's this other kind of weird SM movie called The Night Porter, which is, about this woman who works, Charlotte Rampling, who works at a hotel front desk. And the guy who goes to check in is like this hot German businessman. And then you basically realize that she was in a concentration camp and he was her soldier. But they had this like really weird, erotic sexual relationship. It's such a weird movie. But I highly recommend it. It's called The Night Porter. But anyway, I would like to see more gay movies that are subversive, like just doing weird shit that I just feel like sexuality and people are so complex. It doesn't necessarily have to be dark, but I'm interested in just the complexity of sexuality and, you know, how we're all just weird. And I don't know, I'm fascinated by all that stuff. So I feel like a lot of European movies have obviously delved more into that realm. But it's one of the things I loved about Lena on Girls. Just what a weirdo she is, you know, and that she was like, yeah, I'm going to tell about my relationship where my boyfriend was like kind of abusive, but I was like really into it. You know, like she just was very honest about all the weird stuff that has happened to her. And I just really appreciate that kind of honesty.
Yeah. I liked Tiny Furniture. When I became aware of her, I remember stalking her and reading interviews where she actually talked about, but I'm a cheerleader, a lot.
Oh, really? That's so funny.
Yeah,
I was so excited because I had been like stuck kind of directing crappy network shows, which was really just like sexism at play. Like it was just really hard as a woman to get a good job in like HBO or, you know, those better networks. And because Lena was a fan of Cheerleader, she hired me on Girls. So I just like needed the younger generation to get more powerful to hire me, basically.
Is it getting better for women directors?
Oh my God.
I know
so
there's
much
still
better.
A long ways to go, but.
So much better. So much
yeah,
better.
Yeah. It seems, I mean, I always, you know, watch through the credits of everything and more, and maybe it's just the things I'm drawn to, but
no,
I'm noticing
it's so much
almost
more. So many more names.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we're everywhere. It's pretty great. So, I mean, honestly, Me Too, like, opened the floodgates. Yeah. It was like when I went to film, when I was taking film classes, my classes were like 80% guys, and there were always like two or three of us in the class. So I took classes at NYU, and Julie Delpy and myself were like the two women in the class. And we're both like having careers, which is pretty great. But honestly, now film schools are like 50-50. If not more women, and they're actually getting work because the studios and everyone got shamed into hiring them.
Yeah.
And then they did a great job. So then they're like, yeah. Oh, right, okay. And like the movie I'm most excited about, well, I'm really excited on Thanksgiving weekend about Clea's Christmas movie, but then I'm also really excited about Wonder Woman on Christmas. Like, how cool is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
So excited for that.
I just wanted to wrap up with maybe any advice you would have for our listeners. I know there's always the standard, like, just do it on your own. But if there's any other advice you might have for listeners who might be interested in filmmaking, who might be overcorrect or just like too in their head.
Yeah. And I think that that's a typical like female problem for sure. Like, we're perfectionists, or we don't think we're like good enough to be a director because like, I don't know what I'm doing yet. So how could I call myself like in charge? I will say I did not go to film school, but I took a lot of film classes. And the reason I took a lot of film classes is so that I could make the films in the class, because you have, number one, a deadline. Number two, a group of people who have to help you. Number three, equipment. Number four, all the classes I took, I just took by signing up for them like in the summertime or on, you know, Tuesdays and Thursday nights. Like, actually the script for But I'm a Cheerleader, I wrote after I signed up for a screenwriting class at UCLA Extension. And it was Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I just knew that if I took that class, when I finished, I would have like a draft of the script, because I had a deadline. I had like some just basic structure in place, which I needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have always done that. And like my short films I made as part of an NYU class that I took during the summer, like all those extension classes, I took extension classes at UCLA, NYU, SVA, the film, New York Film Academy, like all those places I did. And so even the short films on the extras of Cheerleader, I made in those extension classes.
Nice.
So, because it is hard to like get a group of people that are going to help you and be empowered enough to ask people to work for free and stuff. But when you're in that class environment, especially those extension classes, it's like military people and older people and just people who are interested in making something. And I just always took them seriously because I was paying for them myself. And it was like way after college I was taking them. So yeah, I think, and it's good to have deadlines. Honestly, deadlines are really important. So
great.
That's my advice.
Love it.
Great. Thank you. Well, listeners, we hope you all go and check out the director's cut of But I'm a Cheerleader. It's coming out December
8th. Not sure.
Jamie, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
I love diking out with you guys. It was super fun. And thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, take care. We look forward to seeing more of your work.
Yay.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
I feel like we have to mention, Melody, that during that whole interview, Jamie was wearing a red and black plaid pajama pants. So gay.
Mm-hmm. And she had her knee up. She was kind of sitting weird like I do, which is supposed to be a bisexual thing, since we learned in our BuzzFeed quiz last week. But
we
she had the weird sit.
It was great. That was so much fun. And I had the most fun preparing for that interview, because not only did I watch the director's cut, but I also watched the original the day before. So I watched But I'm a Cheerleader twice.
Yep.
I watched Addicted to Fresno. I watched Breaking the Girls. I still haven't seen Itty Bitty Titty Committee. I can't find it streaming anywhere, but I will.
Me neither. That's the thing.
Track it down.
Someone call Dan Levy, because we got to track something down. Shall we get into this week's listener question?
We shall. Let's do it.
Let's do it. I've been with my girlfriend for over a year, but over time she will no longer allow me to go down on her / touch her clit / vagina area. I've asked her why, and she says she does not really like it. I expressed to her my desire to please her and that I crave the womanly experience and intimacy of giving her oral and tasting her. Our relationship is so beautiful, and I do feel emotionally and intimately connected with her in other ways besides our sex life. She has a more dominant vibe in the bedroom, and she says that when I go down on her, she feels weak. She knows that me going down on her is so sexy, and I get so turned on. She will make love to me with everything, even our strap-on, but she will not allow me to reciprocate, even with my fingers. Have you ever heard of this dynamic of one person making all the sexual moves? I feel very disappointed and frustrated that I can't connect with her on this level. Am I being selfish to desire this?
Funny thing about this question, it was actually submitted by 20-year-old Carolyn Bergier.
I know.
Just went back in time. And nah, I wasn't in the exact same situation, but very similar. And
we have heard of this dynamic, we should say, and it is common.
It's right? Very common. I think it's very common. And first off, you aren't being selfish to desire that. You know, everybody has different needs sexually, and having those desires isn't selfish. The thing is, you can't change who your partner is. And if they're not comfortable doing those things, then they're not comfortable doing those things. End of story. And you're not sexually compatible. Even though you're compatible in other ways, you are not sexually compatible. That's the fact. And I know how frustrating it is. I'm somebody who is like very much a top. And in one of my past, like very significant relationships, I was with somebody who was not comfortable being touched and who had issues around receiving and around their body that they didn't want me doing those things, even though like all I wanted was to go down on them or to wear the strap or to do those things. And it was very clear to me that I couldn't. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's not why we broke up, but that was something that was like very hard and frustrated for me. And then I didn't realize at the time, like how much my needs weren't being met in those terms, because you do feel like, oh, it's really shitty of me to like not be happy that I can't do the things that I want. And it can feel a little bit selfish, even though I don't think it is.
I've been in this relationship a couple times. First, it was with someone who, like you describe, was very uncomfortable with it. It turned out that we weren't compatible. It was just not something they were comfortable with. It ended up actually turning out that this person had a lot of dysphoria, and they ended up coming out as non-binary. And that's something
Same.
That happens. Yeah. And I think that's very common in the lesbian community.
Yeah.
Or on the flip side, this is in my current relationship. I've experienced this. Allie and I came into our relationship two tops, and we both, it's like a race to see who could top who at the beginning. And then we eventually had to talk about it because we started to realize a pattern. And we're now two verse. Like, we both love each other. We both, it's not something that we were uncomfortable with. It was just a preference. And we both, we get to switch it up. And it was definitely something we had to like approach and decide if it was worth it. Like, we still recognize that we are compatible after all of this. We just had to adapt. So it's not like you don't need to forfeit the relationship if it's not something that the other person is open to working around. But if it like straight up makes them uncomfortable, and if it's something you really want to do and there's no negotiating there, you're just not compatible.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm definitely not saying end the relationship, but you have to assess like how important it is to you to be able to do this, because you don't want it to lead to anything bad. And maybe this is a scenario where your partner would be understanding and maybe would be okay with like opening up the relationship where you can, you know, maybe have like casual physical encounters with other people so that you can be satisfied in terms of being able to give and then have, you know, and then still like receive in this relationship you're in. I don't know. I mean, that would have to be definitely talked about like at length and worked out between you and your partner. There could be solutions, but I also think that you can't just like ignore it and be like, okay, well, I'll never, if I want to be in this relationship, then I have to like not have my sexual needs met there. Mm-hmm. You have to find something that works for you, which is either like some type of compromise in the relationship. But it sounds like where this person is coming from, you definitely should not like pressure them to change, you know, like Melody, what you're saying about you and Allie, like, I've also been there too. I've had exes who were like also tops, and then we both became verse in the relationship, and that's like a little bit different because I'm also comfortable
right
with switching it up, and it's not something where like where I feel like weak if somebody tops me, or I feel like very uncomfortable if somebody tops me.
Yeah, you know, it's not something like, I had an aversion to. It's just a preference from the other. So that was how we could easily right. like settle into our new verse identities. But it depends on yeah where you're coming from.
So
get a pocket pussy. Just kidding. Edit that.
Wait, a pocket pussy?
A pocket pussy.
What is that?
Are you serious, Carolyn?
Am I supposed to have one of these?
No, you're not a straight guy.
Oh, well, why would I know about, fleshlights. Is that the same thing? Is that a pocket pussy?
Yeah, wait, fleshlight's just like a pussy, right?
Yeah, fleshlight is like a tube thing to put your dick in. Well, if you have any questions, you can send them on over to dykingout@gmail.com. And we did get our first request to answer a question via Jemmy. So yes. That's also an option there if you want a video answer for like a more complicated, personalized advice that might not be as relevant to the U-haulers at large. You can go to jemmy.app/dykingout. And you can follow us on social media at Dyking Out. Please DM Melody and at Melody Kamali to bully her into posting more TikTok content. She won't do it for me, but maybe she'll do it for a U-hauler. So please go follow Melody Kamali on Instagram and bully her on my behalf.
If I get 5 DMs this week from U-haulers, I'll make a TikTok. Do you like how I'll only do things with ultimatums like this? If we get X amount of Instagram followers, we'll make a TikTok.
It's a weird kind of love language, but now that I know the code, or in Bly Manor, I know your key now. It's ultimatums.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can follow me at TGI Carolyn, follow us at Dyking Out and at Dyking Out Pod on TikTok. Thank you so much for dyking out with us this week, and we will
see you next Tuesday.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.